Welcome to War Stories. I'm Oliver North, and this is Camp Shelby, Mississippi, today being used to train soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines for the war on terrorism. Back during World War II, with America engaged on three fronts against the Axis powers of Japan, Italy, and Germany, Camp Shelby had an even more sensitive mission, training thousands of Japanese Americans for combat against our enemies overseas. Tonight, the untold story of two unique U.S. military units, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team and the little-known and secretive Military Intelligence Service. The Japanese Americans who answered the call of duty to serve in World War II overcame racism, prejudice, and anger to prove their loyalty to America. Some did so knowing they had relatives serving in the Imperial Japanese Army. Their extraordinary bravery and devotion to duty earned them over 18,000 individual decorations and the right to call themselves American heroes. On that fateful morning of December 7th, 1941, life changed drastically for many of the quarter million Japanese living in the United States.
On Sunday, December the 7th, Franklin Roosevelt was on the radio and he says, Pearl Harbor was being bombed.
I think I was on my way back from church and I said to myself, where's Pearl Harbor?
I cussed under my breath those buggers bringing harm to us. So we're going to do our best to defend ourselves and also our country.
But the story of one of the most decorated units in American history had a challenging beginning.
The Japanese immigrants start coming to Hawaii in the 1880s and then more to the mainland in the 1890s. It's worth pointing out that the Japanese-American population of Hawaii was almost 150,000.
Historian Greg Robinson studied President Franklin Roosevelt's policy toward Japanese immigrants in his book, By Order of the President.
Once the Japanese start succeeding, saving money and buying land, they have all of these techniques for fertilizing marginal land, and they work very hard. Like they pick crops like strawberries, which require an enormous amount of stoop labor. They represented a menace to people once they started buying land in terms of competition to white farmers.
Their prosperity prompted California lawmakers to pass the Alien Land Act in 1913, preventing Issei, or Japanese immigrants, from owning land. Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta shared his father's story with us.
So he got off the ship in Seattle, but unfortunately that put him something like 1,100 miles away from where he was supposed to be. So he had to work from one lumber camp, farm camp, all the way down. And it took him about a year and a half to get from Seattle down to Salinas to Spreckles Sugar Company.
Kunisaku Mineta had come to America to farm sugar beets. Instead, he learned English and became an insurance agent.
And very successful.
And he did very well at it.
And your folks had come from Japan when?
My father came in 1910, my mother in 1915.
Grant Hirabayashi was a Nisei, a second-generation Japanese, born in 1919 to immigrant truck farmers in Washington State.
A lot of people today don't understand why they didn't become American citizens.
They wanted to become citizens, but the law did not permit them. Agents were not allowed to become naturalized.
So they could stay here, they could work here, they could live here, but they couldn't be Americans.
That is correct.
The Immigration Act of 1924, and specifically the passage that barred all immigration by aliens ineligible to citizenship, which by that time meant only the Japanese because all other Asian groups had already been legally barred from citizenship.
But by 1940, there were over 100,000 Japanese living on the West Coast, 94,000 in California alone. 27-year-old Roy Matsumoto was one of them.
I was born in 1913 in a place called Laguna. I was working for the fruit stand, selling vegetables and fruits.
Less than 70 miles east of L.A. in the Inland Empire, 19-year-old George Joe Sakata was learning the ropes of the family trade.
What did you decide to do when you graduated from high school?
Well, I was going to have to work in the grocery store with my family.
As the Sakatos, Matsumotos, and Minettas continued to thrive, so did the resentment.
Had there been discrimination before that, that you recall growing up?
There were slights that you would see. I remember going to some of the major department stores. Someone else would get waited on first, even though we had been standing there a long time.
Californians worked themselves into a state of fear that in case of war, Japanese Americans would poison vegetables, that Japanese Americans would park their cars on roads to prevent army vehicles from getting through.
The fear was palpable. Already a seasoned politician, then 43-year-old FDR wrote in a 1925 column for Georgia's Macon Telegraph.
He said that so far as Americans are concerned, the mingling of white and Oriental blood on any large scale is a potential hazard to our future population.
While most Japanese immigrants were hard at work in pursuit of the American dream, some were loyal to the Empire of Japan.
Let us extend the capital and cover the eight corners of the world under one roof.
In Hawaii, it was hard to tell friend from foe.
They owned most of the small businesses in the islands, and they made a large percentage of the population, upwards of 40%.
Burl Burlingame is the author of Advance Force Pearl Harbor.
It's been said no Japanese Americans ever committed espionage or sabotage leading up to World War II. Well, let's get real.
President Roosevelt receives reports that Japanese ships going to Hawaii are being met by local Japanese Americans.
Japan maintained ties with all Japanese who moved overseas. So they created a network of what they called consular agents in every community.
In fact, in the 1920s, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, who'd go on to orchestrate the attack on Pearl Harbor, was a naval attaché in Washington, D.C. His two-year stint gave him valuable insights into the American psyche. By the fall of 1940, a highly efficient team of crypto analysts led by William Friedman had broken the Japanese diplomatic code. It was dubbed magic because it was so hard to decipher.
The translated magic intercepts were limited to a very small number of people. Secretary of War Henry Stimson and his assistant John McCloy. President Roosevelt had access at certain times to the magic intercepts.
You're looking at a translated copy of a magic cable sent December 1st, 1941, from a Japanese agent in Honolulu to Tokyo. It reports in great detail on ship locations in Pearl Harbor. Quote, "The usual schedule for departure and return of the battleship is leaving on Tuesday and returning on Friday," end quote. But the sad truth is, this crucial piece of intelligence was translated 3 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Some people have called the magic cables the smoking gun. Well, that's really only clear in hindsight.
It's only after the beginning of January 1942 that a campaign of hysteria starts to build among Californians for the removal of Japanese Americans.
In one of the most controversial acts by any president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt signs Executive Order 9066, consigning 120,000 civilians to life behind barbed wire. Find out why when War Stories continues. In its quest for expansion in the Pacific, the Empire of Japan controlled a staggering 550,000 square miles of the Earth's surface by December 7, 1941. The aftermath of the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor was grim. 21 warships either damaged or sunk, over 2,400 Americans dead, and in the midst of those burials, the U.S. declared war.
We're on the island of Oahu. This is where Pearl Harbor and the major city of Honolulu is located. About 160 miles to the northwest is the island of Niihau.
This privately owned island hides one of the most bizarre chapters of World War II.
It was the place where Japanese pilots were supposed to go if their plane was injured. It was either that or go right into the drink.
Shigenori Nishikaichi's Zero is badly leaking fuel after a dogfight with an American P-36.
Pilot Officer Shigenori Nishikaichi crashed on the island of Niihau around noon on December 7th.
Like many of the islanders, native Hawaiian Howard Koleahano didn't even know Pearl Harbor had been attacked. Going on suspicion, he confiscated the pilot's papers and gun.
But what the pilot didn't know, and turned out to aid him later, is that there were several Japanese Americans also on the island. The pilot talked the Japanese, a fellow named Shintani and a couple named Harada, into throwing in with him. After they seized these weapons, Nishikaichi and Harada were terrorizing their neighbors. Some of the Hawaiians escaped and they rowed to Kauai, but it took almost a full day to do it.
On the sixth day of their bloody rampage, they took this man, Ben Kanahili, and his wife hostage.
And there was a scuffle. And he pulled out his knife and cut the pilot's throat while his wife beat his head in with a rock. Harada, seeing this, turned the shotgun on himself and shot himself in the stomach. By the time the troops arrived from Kauai the next day, the Battle of Niihau was over.
Word of this strange encounter reached Washington, where it raised eyebrows.
This incident, even though it was isolated, became the justification for moving tens of thousands of Japanese Americans, otherwise loyal, away from the West Coast.
Historian Greg Robinson disagrees.
There is no evidence that the Niihau incident was in itself particularly influential in influencing FDR's decision or the conduct of the War Department.
62-year-old Lieutenant General John DeWitt was in charge of the Western Defense Command. The Princeton graduate from Nebraska shared FDR's mistrust of the Japanese in America.
General DeWitt was so impassioned against the Japanese Americans that even when he admitted that there were no reports of sabotage or espionage, this did not prove for him that the Japanese Americans were loyal.
He genuinely feared a Japanese invasion occurring on his watch. With the support of Secretary of War Henry Stimson, General DeWitt, citing military necessity, recommended to FDR that all people of Japanese descent, including American citizens, be removed from the Pacific coast. There was considerable opposition. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover was against it. Attorney General Frances Biddle was against it. And so was the First Lady.
She tries to speak to her husband about the issue, and he tells her that he doesn't want to hear about it.
President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 on 19 February 1942. 4 days later, during a fireside chat, a Japanese submarine shelled an oil field on Elwood Beach, Goleta, California.
The text did not mention Japanese Americans, but it was clear to everybody that the purpose of the order was to permit the Army to take care of Japanese Americans.
120,000 Japanese living in military zones in Washington, Oregon, California, and parts of Arizona had to relocate. Those living in the rest of the country, including Hawaii and Alaska, were exempt.
The Army came up with the idea of voluntary migration. That is, Japanese Americans who could get a sponsor would be permitted to relocate from the West Coast and move somewhere else on their own.
What went through your mind at that point?
We were not the enemy. I belong here.
It soon became apparent that this was not a real possibility for the overwhelming majority of people. They didn't have the funds. Their bank accounts of Issei were frozen. They didn't know anybody in other places.
The Army gradually began the arduous task of relocating some 120,000 Japanese Americans. They took over facilities to use as temporary assembly centers.
And they're off!
The famed Santa Anita Racetrack, where 78,000 had cheered Seabiscuit to victory only 2 years before, was now home to Norman Mineta and Roy Matsumoto.
How much were you allowed to take with you?
Only what we could carry.
So you were living in a horse stall at Santa Anita?
Yes, right.
For months?
6 months.
And there they stayed until the network of camps created by a civilian agency, the War Relocation Authority, is created.
Headed by then Major General Dwight Eisenhower's brother Milton, FDR created the War Relocation Authority on 18 March 1942. At least 10,000 Germans and Italians were also sent to internment camps scattered throughout the country. These were different from the relocation camps where the Japanese were confined.
German and Italian aliens, they're given loyalty hearings in which they're unable to present evidence as to their individual loyalty. None of the Japanese Americans are given loyalty hearings.
By May 1942, spread out over these seven states, 10 camps were built to house the Japanese internees.
In fact, Japanese Americans in many cases helped build the camps that would confine them.
Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta was 10 years old when he was ordered from his home in California and forced into a Wyoming relocation camp. The rest of his saga, from confinement to Congress, when War Stories returns. February 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, a controversial decree which resulted in the confinement of 120,000 civilians of Japanese descent.
I think you said to me at one point that you only saw your dad cry three times in his life.
The first was on the 7th of December, because he loved this country and he couldn't understand why the land of his birth was attacking the land of his heart. And the second time was the day that we boarded the trains when we were being evacuated from our homes and interned in camps for the duration of World War II. And the third time was in 1956 when my mother passed away.
Then 10-year-old Norman Mineta and his family were shipped here, Heart Mountain Relocation Center in Wyoming.
This camp, by the way, is surrounded by barbed wire.
Barbed wire and military guard towers with machine gun mounts.
Describe the life that you lived in that camp.
The unit, roughly 15 by 20 feet. It was single wall construction, so the cold and the sand and all that would come whistling right through every unit.
They took away all the privileges of being resident of the United States.
25-year-old Army Private Ken Otagaki remembers visiting his brother Richard at Heart Mountain. Ken had enlisted before the war and later joined the Army's 100th Infantry Battalion, made up of Hawaii-born Nisei, exempt from relocation. But his brother Richard, who was in school in California, wasn't as fortunate.
He was just about ready to graduate when the war came along. He was herded up and placed in a relocation camp.
Though there was plenty of food, life in a relocation camp was Spartan at best. But there was some entertainment.
The Boy Scouts became the center of our activity. They then invited the Boy Scouts from outside the camp to come into the camp to join us for our jamboree. I got paired off with this one guy, and that kid was Alan Simpson, who, of course, became the U.S. Senator from Wyoming.
Barely a year after he signed Executive Order 9066, FDR had a change of heart. We were fighting a war on three fronts and needed more troops.
The Roosevelt administration sought to promote segregated units, the Tuskegee Airmen being another example.
Chad Daniels is the director of the Armed Forces Museum at Camp Shelby, Mississippi.
The 100th Battalion had gained quite a reputation as well-trained, well-disciplined soldiers.
I like to be with my own kind. We were among friends, and we want to be as good soldiers as possible.
This made an impression on military commanders that reviewed those soldiers.
Partly due to the success and dedication of Ken Otagaki's 100th Battalion, FDR decided to form a larger all-Japanese unit. And on 1 February 1943, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team was activated. FDR looked to the relocation centers for volunteers. One of the 1,100 who stepped forward was Roy Matsumoto.
U.S. Army recruiting officer shows up at the camp in Arkansas.
Camp in Arkansas, yes. I volunteered to go.
Why?
I want freedom, you know, so I want to get out.
They were treated as traitors, and yet they became among the most patriotic fighters.
The 442nd Regimental Combat Team that trained right here, just like these soldiers, saves the lives of 200 Texans of the famous Lost Battalion trapped in the hills of France. That's next on War Stories.
With casualties mounting in a three-front war, Roosevelt needed more boots on the ground. In February of 43, he formed the All-Nisei 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which included some 1,100 volunteers from the relocation camps. By that summer, 4,000 soldiers of the 442nd and the Hawaiian 100th Battalion were training side by side at Camp Shelby, Mississippi. Among them, 24-year-old Utah farm boy Yuki Managa.
And I thought, being a radio chief, I'd never have to go to the front. So I could rely on my four men to do the work. And I found out when we first hit the line in May, the old man told me, you go up front with the lieutenant. And since that time, I was about the only one that went up front all the time.
So much for getting out of the front line.
It was quite an experience.
They were going to train us for jungle fighting. And of course, we had a lot of snakes, chiggers, and ticks.
Was there any friction between the Japanese Americans who lived here in the United States and those who had come from Hawaii?
We couldn't understand what they're talking about. That pidgin English they're talking. You come Bombay, I go, you, what?
They were most enthusiastic. But after a couple of weeks of action, I think they changed their minds.
September 1943, 1,300 soldiers from the 100th were shipped off to Italy.
We landed in Salerno. But unfortunately for my landing craft, we got hung up on a sandbar. I went straight down, and I almost drowned.
Private Otagaki moved inland, where Field Marshal Albert Kesselring's battle-hardened German Wehrmacht lay waiting at Monte Cassino.
United States and Allied forces came up against very stiff German resistance that could not be easily overcome.
January 10th, 1944. Mortar fire was coming over. I don't know how many rounds before I felt a blast. My fingers were dangling, my leg was dangling, but I had them all. They took us to a evacuation hospital. And that's where they did the first surgery. You know, the dangling fingers were taken off, the leg, part of the leg was taken off.
Mount Cassino was where the 100th Battalion became known as the Purple Heart Battalion. The Germans were shooting down the, like fish in a barrel, and then everybody getting shot and wounded.
The 100th lost more than half their fighting force and desperately needed reinforcements. Half a world away at Camp Shelby, George Josakato and Yuki Managa of the 442nd were eager to help. 14 August 1944, the 100th and 442 leave their differences behind and merge to become the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. This is George Josakato a month later in northern France, mired in knee-deep mud. Just moments later, he faced the enemy for the first time and one of his buddies was hit.
He lay down face down. Turned him over, and his jugular veins, blood is streaming out like a lead pencil's coming out. And I said, oh, this is what battle is about.
Lieutenant Marty Higgins from Jersey City was a fish out of water when he joined the 141st Texas Regiment, 36th Infantry Division. After a brief stint as a Buffalo soldier in the cavalry, this 28-year-old Irish Catholic was anxious to seek combat.
I was sent to the 36th Division. Fortunately, when they're in a staging area, for the southern in France invasion.
2 months later, in October of 44, Lieutenant Higgins spearheaded the drive into the Vosges Mountains in northeastern France. These 150 miles of rugged terrain were in Hitler's backyard. The Allies hoped to push the Führer's Wehrmacht, led by General Hermann Balck, back into Germany before Christmas.
We were attacking the Vosges Mountains, the Germans ahead of us, and they were attacking us on both sides. And I told Colonel Byrd we're going to get cut off. And he said, press on, there'll be other troops behind us. The Germans closed the trap, and there we were.
275 men of the 141st Regiment were trapped on a steep ridge 3 miles behind enemy lines. From his headquarters in Berlin, Hitler ordered his troops to go in for the kill.
We were ordered to fight our way back. But by then, we had so many wounded, we were running short of ammunition, and there's no way we could fight our way out.
They were cut off for about 6 days, and there were attempts to resupply them by air, but unfortunately most of the parachuted goods dropped them to the Germans.
There was no panic. We handled the situation as best we could.
The 442nd had been engaged in heavy combat to take Bruyères, France. After about a week of really heavy fighting, they were pulled off the line to refit, recuperate.
But there would be no time for R&R. The Nisei soldiers were called to rescue their brothers in arms. It would prove to be one of the most ferocious engagements of World War II.
You're a forward observer on a mission to rescue an army battalion that was nicknamed the Lost Battalion.
And word came out that we're going back up the front to rescue an outfit that got mousetrapped up there by the Germans.
The 442nd was on the move toward Lieutenant Higgins and his beleaguered Texans. Facing heavy enemy fire, George Sicato desperately tried to charge up Hill 617. Then tragedy struck.
Friend, I don't know, he got shot. I crawled over this hole and I picked him up, and he just gurgled, you know, and he's trying to say something, but then he went limp on me, and I'm looking at my hands and I'll see all this blood. Why? I held him tight and nothing. Got out of that hole and I ran up that hill. And I could never climb the hill before. I was always the last one up the hill. But that day, I don't know where the extra energy came from.
Armed only with a German P-38 and a rifle, Sicato repeatedly ran into enemy fire, killing 12, wounding 2, and capturing 4. Then he got hit.
Was it a bullet or shrapnel?
Shrapnel. It's about the size of my fingernail. It went through there and hit my spine and ricocheted, and it's still here.
Meanwhile, Yuki Minaga and the rest of the 442nd battled their way up to Lieutenant Higgins and his men.
Colonel Purcell come running up there, and he said, rush up that hill. We've almost got it. We've almost captured the hill.
There's only a handful of guys who actually make it to the top of that ridge.
How we got there, I don't know, but we got there. We started over towards where the Lost Battalion were in camp.
After a fierce six-day battle, the 442nd finally broke through to the remaining 211 men of the Lost Battalion.
The Lost Battalion of the Second World War had been relieved.
This is actual footage of the rescue.
When you got up there, were they glad to see you guys?
I never saw a happier bunch of guys in my life. Some were crying, and most of them were yelling and raising their hands.
I thought the world of them. I still do. We never knew the casualties they had endured. These men died to save us.
Coming up, the men who volunteered for a dangerous and hazardous mission and lived to tell the story. That's next on War Stories. By 1944, 16,000 Nisei had answered the call to duty, and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team's magnificent fighting spirit was legendary in the trenches and mountains of Europe. But what you may not know is that some were sent to fight against their parents' homeland in the Pacific. One of them was Grant Hirabayashi.
What is it you wanted to prove?
That I'm an American. A loyal American to prove.
And so was Californian Roy Matsumoto, but he had a different dilemma with his brothers.
You've got a real challenge here. You've got family on the other side.
What happened was that Consular General in Los Angeles came to his home and tell him, would you like to go to Japan as an exchange student, all tuition, and room and board, free? This is too good to be true.
Pretty good deal.
Pretty good deal. But instead of going to Japan, send it to Southern Manchuria.
Though he didn't know it at the time, Matsumoto didn't have one but two brothers in the Imperial Army, which by the spring of 42 had conquered Burma and starved most of China into submission. The brutal Japanese advance posed a grave threat to our only ally in the Far East. The Imperial Army had to be stopped. FDR and Winston Churchill launched a secret mission to put troops behind enemy lines in Burma and reopen the supply line to China. they looked to two unconventional warriors to lead the way, British Major General Ord Wingate and the 41-year-old American Brigadier General Frank Merrill. The 3,000 Americans who volunteered for the dangerous and hazardous mission were known as Merrill's Marauders.
Merrill's Marauders was a special task force. 14 Japanese Americans with the Military Intelligence Service were chosen to go with Merrill's Marauders between February and August of 1944 into Burma.
Suddenly found out that you were very well qualified for military intelligence.
Yes.
What kind of training did you get?
It was translation from Japanese to English. Had memorized all the technical terms, military terms, history, the culture, and the custom of Japanese.
What do you know about the mission at that point?
They said, well, expect 85% casualties.
After 4 months of jungle warfare training in India with General Wingate's British Chindits, each of the six combat teams was assigned to Nisei. Staff Sergeant Matsumoto joined Philip Piazza's Blue Team in the 2nd Battalion. 60 years later, we brought them together again to share their war stories.
Oh, hi, Phil. Hey, nice to see you.
27-year-old Phil Piazza from Connecticut and Roy Matsumoto began their 700-mile trek through the jungles of Burma. It was a hot, muggy day in March of 44 when they struck gold.
You overhear a Japanese sergeant talking about guarding an ammunition dump.
We saw this fire going through the trees. And we were in the middle of this firefight, and I'm firing my mortars, and I had him take my field phone. He climbed the tree. He tapped into the line. And as he tapped in, these two soldiers are talking to the commanding officer. He gave the coordinates of their position.
Suspended high above the ground for an entire day and vulnerable to sniper fire, Roy Matsumoto relayed the coordinates to Lieutenant Piazza, who called in the airstrikes.
They had 500-pound bombs under their wings. They come right over our heads, knocked out the dump.
A month later, in the battle for Napunga, 800 American troops were surrounded by Lieutenant General Shinichi Tanaka's 18th Division. Staff Sergeant Matsumoto outsmarted the enemy once again.
He stripped and sneaked down there, listened to the Japanese officers giving their orders. You know, the Japanese were very noisy soldiers.
Roy, could you tell what the Japanese who surrounded you were saying?
So they're talking about the family thing, you know, how his wife is suffering. Just like we do in the foxhole talk, what do you do when you get out of there? He said, I may raise a chicken or something like that.
But he also learned of plans for a banzai charge the next morning. The Americans made ready and held their fire until the enemy was inches away. Then Matsumoto sprung into action.
He stood up one time and yelled, charge in Japanese, and they charged. And I hate to tell you how many people mowed down.
Because of Matsumoto's actions that day, the Marauders suffered no casualties and won the battle. Meanwhile, Grant Hirabayashi was suffering a different kind of hell. A fractured elbow and severe allergies to K rations left him weak and malnourished. After 2 months of combat, he was evacuated, but returned for an encounter he'd never forget.
When you're out there in the jungle and you're being called upon to essentially be a spy. Grant, there comes a time when you have to interrogate a captured Japanese prisoner. And he says something to you that I would think would be kind of hurtful.
And he looked at me and he said, you're a traitor. I said, traitor? I said, don't you call me a traitor. I said, if we were to cut our vein, I guess the same blood will flow. But see me, I'm an American soldier, and you're a Japanese soldier. You're fighting for your country and fighting for mine. Don't you call me a traitor.
During the 5-month campaign, 120 died and 2,000 fell victim to disease. General Frank Merrill said of the Nisei, quote, I couldn't have gotten along without them.
Coming up, how Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta fought to restore the dignity of his people. That's next on War Stories.
When President Roosevelt died on 12 April 1945, there were still 73,000 Japanese Americans interned in relocation camps, and some 10,000 were fighting overseas.
Franklin Roosevelt seems never to have regretted his decision. All that we can figure out is that he thought that it was a small matter. They would go back when the war was over.
By the time the last camp closed in March of 46, those who were forced to leave everything behind had lost an estimated 400 million. That's 4.2 billion in today's dollars. With over 18,000 individual medals, the 442nd emerged as the most decorated combat unit of their size in the history of the U.S. Army. Among them, Ken Odagaki, Yuki Managa, Roy Matsumoto, and Grant Hirabayashi. But homecoming was often bittersweet, even for bona fide war heroes.
You got home the same month that the war ends. What did you do?
I went to trucking companies, railroad companies. You got 10 years experience? I just got out of the Army. How am I going to have 10 years experience? They just looked at me and they said, it's a Jap.
And it would take 30 years to begin the process of righting a wrong. In 1976, President Gerald Ford formally revoked Executive Order 9066. 4 years later, Congress created a special commission to revisit FDR's decision.
In 1983, they issue their official report, which says that Executive Order 9066 and the actions which flowed from it were not based on military security, but were based fundamentally in wartime hysteria, racism, and a failure of political leadership.
Members of Congress and distinguished guests, my fellow Americans, we gather here today to right a grave wrong.
In 1988, President Reagan signs an official apology and a redress payment of $20,000 to each surviving Japanese American who had been covered under Executive Order 9066.
To me, it wasn't the payments, but it was the apology and that lifting of the yoke that people had on their back about what they experienced from World War II up to that point.
You were also very instrumental in getting that memorial built.
This memorial is really to those who were in the camps, those who served in the military, in both the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, as well as the Military Intelligence Service, because many of us are really standing on the shoulders of those folks.
And in 2000, President Bill Clinton personally presented 22 Medals of Honor to Japanese Americans, one of them, George Josakato.
You got a call to go to the White House.
55 years later, I get this call from the Pentagon. I want you to come to the White House. I want to have a upgrade your Distinguished Service Cross, the Medal of Honor.
When I think about my dad coming as a 14-year-old kid and his son being able to be in the cabinet of two presidents, to me, there isn't a country in the world that can give that kind of opportunity.
But to this day, Japan has not made a formal apology for her actions during World War II or paid a single cent in reparations to their slave laborers.
Stay tuned for more war stories on the Fox News Channel.
A year after he forced tens of thousands of Japanese Americans into relocation camps, FDR had a change of heart. It was a pragmatic decision. The Army, Navy, and Marines needed the daring and skill of the Japanese Americans to defeat our enemies. The formation of the Military Intelligence Service and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team reflected that reality, as did President Roosevelt's words, "Americanism is not and never was a matter of race or ancestry." The Japanese Americans who served in World War II did so with courage, sacrifice, and distinction. Despite the many obstacles they faced, their loyalty never wavered. Their patriotism is unquestioned. Theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.